Over that he wore a mantle of blue velvet, decorated with 100 golden hands. Sir Harry's had been thrilled by his appointment, too dim to realize that he was more hostage than hand. His daughter was her uncle's wife, and Kevin loved his chinless lady, flat-chested and chicken-legged as she was. So long as she had Sir Harry's in hand, Kevin Lannister must needs think twice about opposing her. To be sure, a good father is not the ideal hostage, but better a flimsy shield than none. "Will the king be joining us?" asked Orton Merryweather. "My son is playing with his little queen. For the moment, his idea of kingship is stamping papers with the royal seal. His grace is still too young to comprehend affairs of state."
"And our valiant Lord Commander?"
"Sir Jamie is at his armourer's being fitted for a hand. I know we were all tired of that ugly stump, and I dare say he would find these proceedings as tiresome as Tommen." Arrayne Waters chuckled at that. "Good," Cersei thought. "The more they laugh, the less he is a threat. Let them laugh. Do we have wine?"
"Oh, we do, Your Grace."
Orton Merryweather was not a comely man, with his big, lumpish nose and shock of unruly, reddish-orange hair, but he was never less than courteous.
"We have Dornish red and arbor gold, and a fine sweet hippocras from High Garden."
"The gold, I think. I find Dornish wines as sour as the Dornish." As Merryweather filled her cup, Cersei said, "I suppose we had as well begin with them." Grand Maester Pycelle's lips were still quivering, yet somehow he found his tongue.
"As you command, Prince Doran has taken his brother's unruly bastards into custody, yet Sunspear still seethes. The prince writes that he cannot hope to calm the waters until he receives the justice that was promised him."
"To be sure."
"A tiresome creature, this prince."
"His long wait is almost done. I'm sending Balon Swan to Sunspear to deliver him the head of Gregor Clegane."
Sir Balon would have another task as well, but that part was best left unsaid.
"Ah!"
Sir Harry Swift fumbled at his funny little beard with thumb and forefinger.
"He is dead, then, Sir Gregor?"
"I would think so, my lord," Orin Water said dryly. "I am told that removing the head from the body is often mortal."
Cersei favoured him with a smile. She liked a bit of wit, so long as she was not its target.
"Sir Gregor perished of his wounds, just as Grand Maester Pycelle foretold."
Pycelle humped and eyed Qyburn Sarley.
"The spear was poisoned. No man could have saved him."
"So you said. I recall it well." The queen turned to her hand.
"What were you speaking of when I arrived, Sir Harris?"
"Sparrows, Your Grace. Septon Reynard says there may be as many as 2,000 in the city, and more arriving every day. Their leaders preach of doom and demon worship."
Cersei took a taste of wine. Very nice. "And long past time, wouldn't you agree? What would you call this red god that Stannis worships, if not a demon? The faith should oppose such evil." Qyburn had reminded her of that, the clever man.
"Our late High Septon let too much pass, I fear. Age had dimmed his sight and sapped his strength."
"Ach, he was an old done man, Your Grace."
Qyburn smiled at Pycelle.
"His passing should not have surprised us. No man can ask for more than to die peacefully in his sleep, full of years."
"No," said Cersei, "but we must hope that his successor is more vigorous. My friends upon the other hill tell me that it will most like be Torbert or Reynard."
Grand Maester Pycelle cleared his throat.
"I have friends amongst the most devout as well, and they speak of Septon Olidor."
"Do not discount this man, Lucian," Qyburn said. "Last night he fated 30,
of the most devout on Suckling Pig and Arbor Gold, and by day he hands out hard bread to the poor to prove his piety."
Orm Waters seemed as bored as Cersei by all this prattle about septons. Seen up close, his hair was more silvery than gold, and his eyes were grey-green, where Prince Rhaegar's had been purple. Even so, the resemblance? She wondered if Waters would shave his beard for her. Though he was 10 years her junior, he wanted her. Cersei could see it in the way he looked at her. Men had been looking at her that way since her breasts began to bud. "Because I was so beautiful," they said. But Jaime was beautiful as well, and they never looked at him that way. When she was small, she would sometimes don her brother's clothing as a lark. She was always startled by how differently men treated her when they thought she was Jaime. Even Lord Tywin himself. Pycelle and Merryweather were still quibbling about who the new High Septon was like to be. "One will serve as well as the other," the Queen announced abruptly. "But whosoever dons the crystal crown must pronounce an anathema upon the imp." This last High Septon had been conspicuously silent regarding Tyrion.
"As for these pink sparrows, so long as they preach no treason, they are the faith's problem, not ours."
Lord Orton and Sir Harry's murmured agreement. Giles Rusby's attempt to do the same dissolved into a fit of coughing. Cersei turned away in distaste, as he was hacking up a gob of bloody phlegm.
"Maester, have you brought the letter from the Vale?"
"I have, Your Grace."
Pycelle plucked it from his pile of papers and smoothed it out.
"It is a declaration rather than a letter, signed at Runestone by Bronze Jan Royce, Lady Wainwood, Lords Hunter, Redfort and Belmore, and Simon Templeton, the Knight of Nine Stars. All have affixed their seals. They write
a deal of rubbish.
My lords may read the letter if they wish. Royce and these others are massing men below the Eyrie. They mean to remove Littlefinger as Lord Protector of the Vale, forcibly, if need be. The question is, ought we allow this? Does Lord Baelish seek our help? Asked Harry Swift. Not as yet. In truth, he seems quite unconcerned. His last letter mentions the rebels only briefly before beseeching me to ship him some old tapestries of Robert's.
Sir Harry's fingered his chin-beard.
And these lords of the Declaration, do they appeal to the king to take a hand?
They do not.
Then, mayhaps, we need do nothing.
A war in the Vale would be most tragic, said Pycelle.
War? Orton Merryweather laughed. Lord Baelish is a most amusing man, but one does not fight war with witticisms. I doubt there will be bloodshed. And does it matter who is regent for little Lord Robert, so long as the Vale remits his taxes?
No, Cersei decided. If truth be told, Littlefinger had been more use at court. He had a gift for finding gold, and never coughed.
Lord Orton has convinced me. Maester Pycelle, instruct these lords declarant that no harm must come to Peter. Elsewise, the crown is content with whatever dispositions they might make for the governance of the Vale during Robert Aaron's minority.
Very good, Your Grace.
Might we discuss the fleet? Asked Orm Waters. Fewer than a dozen of our ships survived the inferno on the Blackwater. We must needs restore our strength at sea.
Harry Swift nodded.
Strength at sea is most essential. Could we make use of the iron men? Asked Orton Merryweather. The enemy of our enemy. What would the Sea Stone Chair want of us as the price of an alliance?
They want the North.
Grand Maester Pycelle said,
which our Queen's noble father promised to House Bolton.
How inconvenient, said Merryweather. Still, the north is large. The lands could be divided. It need not be a permanent arrangement. Bolton might consent, so long as we assure him that our strength will be his once Stannis is destroyed.
Balin Greyjoy is dead, I had heard, said Sir Harry Swift. Do we know who rules the Isles now? Did Lord Balin have a son?
Leo, coughed Lord Giles. Theo.
Theon Greyjoy was raised at Winterfell, a ward of Eddard Stark, Kyburn said. He's not like to be a friend of ours.
I had heard he was slain, said Merryweather.
Was there only one son?
Sir Harry Swift tugged upon his chin beard.
Brothers, there were brothers, were there not?
Varys would have known, Cersei thought with irritation. I do not propose to climb in bed with that sorry pack of squids. Their turn will come once we have dealt with Stannis. What we require is our own fleet.
I propose we build new Drommons, said Oraine Waters. 10 to start with.
Where is the coin to come from? Asked Pycelle.
Lord Giles took that as an invitation to begin coughing again. He brought up more pink spittle and dabbed it away with a square of red silk.
There is no...
he managed before the coughing ate his words.
No, no, we do not.
Sir Harris proved swift enough at least to grasp the meaning between the coughs.
The crown incomes have never been greater, he objected. Sir Kevin told me so himself.
Lord Giles coughed.
Expenses, gold cloaks.
Cersei had heard his objections before.
Our Lord Treasurer is trying to say that we have too many gold cloaks and too little gold.
Rosby's coughing had begun to vex her.
Perhaps Garth the Gross would not have been so ill.
Though large, the crown incomes are not large enough to keep abreast of Robert's debts. Accordingly, I have decided to defer our repayment of the sums owed the Holy Faith and the Iron Bank of Braavos until war's end. The new High Septon would doubtless wring his holy hands, and the Braavosi would squeal and squawk at her. But what of it?
The money saved will be used for the building of our new fleet.
Your Grace is prudent, said Lord Merryweather. This is a wise measure, and indeed, until the war is done, I concur.
And I, said Sir Harris.
Your Grace, Pycelle said in a quavering voice, this will cause more trouble than you know, I fear. The Iron Bank remains on Braavos, far across the sea. They shall have their gold, maester. A Lannister pays his debts.
The Braavosi have a saying, too. Pycelle's jewel chain clinked softly. The Iron Bank will have its due, they say.
The Iron Bank will have its due when I say they will. Until such time, the Iron Bank will wait respectfully.
Lord Waters, commence the building of your Drommons.
Very good, Your Grace.
Sir Harry's shuffled through some papers.
The next matter. We have had a letter from Lord Frey putting forth some claims.
How many lands and honours does that man want? Snapped the Queen.
His mother must have had 3 teats.
My lords may not know, said Kyburn, but in the wine-sinks and pot-shops of the city, there are those who suggest that the crown might have been somehow complicit in Lord Walder's crime.
The other councillors stared at him uncertainly.
Do you refer to the Red Wedding? Asked Orham Waters.
Crime, said Sir Harris.
Pycelle cleared his throat noisily.
Lord Giles coughed.
These sparrows are especially outspoken, warned Kyburn. The Red Wedding was an affront to all the laws of gods and men, they say, and those who had a hand in it are damned.
Cersei was not slow to take his meaning.
Lord Walder must soon face the father's judgment. He is very old. Let the sparrows spit upon his memory. It has naught to do with us.
No, said Sir Harry.
No,
said Lord Merryweather.
No one could think so, said Pycelle.
Lord Giles coughed.
A little spittle on Lord Walder's tomb is not like to disturb the grave worms,
Kyburn agreed.
But it would also be useful if someone were to be punished for the red wedding. A few frey heads would do much to mollify the North.
Lord Walder will never sacrifice his own, said Pycelle.
No, mused Cersei. But his heirs may be less squeamish.
Lord Walder may soon do us the courtesy of dying, we can hope. What better way for the new Lord of the Crossing to rid himself of inconvenient half-brothers, disagreeable cousins, and scheming sisters than by naming them the culprits?
Whilst we await Lord Walder's death, there is another matter, said Orin Waters. The Golden Company has broken its contract with Myr. Around the docks I've heard men say that Lord Stannis has hired them and is bringing them across the sea.
What would he pay them with?
Asked Merryweather.
Snow? They're called the Golden Company. How much gold does Stannis have?
Little enough, Cersei assured him. Lord Kyburn has spoken to the crew of that Meerish galley in the bay. They claim the Golden Company is making for Volantis. If they mean to cross the Westeros, they are marching in the wrong direction.
Perhaps they grow weary of fighting on the losing side, suggested Lord Merryweather.
There is that as well, agreed the Queen. Only a blind man could fail to see our war is all but won. Lord Tyrell has Storm's End invested. Riverrun is besieged by the Freys and my cousin Davin, our new Warden of the West. Lord Redwyn's ships have passed through the Straits of Tarth and are moving swiftly up the coast. Only a few fishing boats remain on Dragonstone to oppose Redwyn's landing. The castle may hold for some time, but once we have the port, we can cut the garrison off from the sea. Then only Stannis himself will remain to vex us.
If Lord Janus can be believed, he is trying to make common cause with the wildlings,
warned Grand Maester Pycelle.
Savages in skins, declared Lord Merryweather.
Lord Stannis must be desperate indeed to seek such allies.
Desperate and foolish, the Queen agreed. The Northmen hate the wildlings. Roose Bolton should have no trouble winning them to our cause. A few have already joined up with his bastard son to help him clear the wretched ironman from Moat Caelan, and clear the way for Lord Bolton to return. Umber, Riswell, I forget the other names. Even White Harbour is on the point of joining us. Its lord has agreed to marry both his granddaughters to our friends of Frey, and open his port to our ships.
I thought we had no ships,
Sir Harry said, confused.
Wyman Manderley was a loyal bannerman to Eddard Stark,
said Grand Maester Pycelle.
Can such a man be trusted?
No one can be trusted.
He's a fat old man and frightened. However, he is proving stubborn on one point. He insists that he will not bend the knee until his heir has been returned to him.
Do we have this heir?
Asked Sir Harris. He will be at Harren Hall, if he is still alive. Gregor Clegane took him captive. The Mountain had not always been gentle with his prisoners, even those worth a goodly ransom.
If he is dead, I suppose we will need to send Lord Manderley the heads of those who killed him, with our most sincere apologies.
If one head was enough to appease a Prince of Dawn, a bag of them should be more than adequate for a fat Northman wrapped in sealskins.
Will not Lord Stannis seek to win the allegiance of White Harbour as well?
Asked Grand Maester Pycelle.
Oh, he has tried. Lord Manderley has sent his letters on to us and replied with evasions. Stannis demands White Harbour's swords and silver, for which he offers, well, nothing.
One day she must light a candle to the stranger for carrying Renly off and leaving Stannis. If it had been the other way round, her life would have been harder. Just this morning there was another bird. Stannis has sent his onion smuggler to treat with White Harbour on his behalf. Manderley has clapped the wretch inside a cell. He asked us what he should do with him.
"Send him here, that we might question him," suggested Lord Merryweather. "The man might know much of value."
"Let him die," said Caiman. "His death will be a lesson to the North, to show them what becomes of traitors."
"I quite agree," the Queen said. "I have instructed Lord Manderley to have his head off forthwith. That should put an end to any chance of White Harbour supporting Stannis."
"Stannis will need another hand," observed Orin Waters with a chuckle. "The turnip knight, perhaps."
"A turnip knight?" said Sir Harry Swift, confused. "Who is this man? I've not heard of him."
Waters did not reply, except to roll his eyes.
"What if Lord Manderley should refuse?" asked Merryweather.
"He dare not.
The onion knight's head is the coin he'll need to buy his son's life."
Cersei smiled. "The fat old fool may have been loyal to the Starks in his own way, but with the Wolves of Winterfell extinguished—"
"Your Grace has forgotten the Lady Sansa," said Pycelle.
The Queen bristled. "I most certainly have not forgotten that little she-wolf." She refused to say the girl's name. "I ought to have shown her to the black cells as the daughter of a traitor, but instead I made her part of mine own household. She shared my hearth and hall, played with my own children. I fed her, dressed her, tried to make her a little less ignorant about the world. And how did she repay me for my kindness? She helped murder my son. When we find the imp, we will find the Lady Sansa too. She is not dead. But before I am done with her, I promise you, she will be singing to the stranger, begging for his kiss." An awkward silence followed. "Have they all swallowed their tongues?" Cersei thought, with irritation. It was enough to make her wonder why she bothered with a council. "In any case," the Queen went on, "Lord Eddard's younger daughter is with Lord Bolton, and will be wed to his son Ramsay as soon as Moat Cailin has fallen." So long as the girl played her role well enough to cement their claim to Winterfell, neither of the Boltons would much care that she was actually some Stuart's whelp, tricked up by Littlefinger. "If the North must have a Stark, we'll give them one." She let Lord Merryweather fill her cup once again. "Another problem has arisen on the Wall, however. The Brothers of the Night's Watch have taken leave of their wits and chosen Ned Stark's bastard son to be their Lord Commander. Snow, the boy is called," Pycelle said unhelpfully. "I glimpsed him once at Winterfell," the Queen said. "Though the Starks did their best to hide him, he looks very like his father." Her husband's byblows had his look as well, though at least Robert had the grace to keep them out of sight. Once, after that sorry business with the cat, he had made some noises about bringing some base-born daughter of his to court. "Do as you please," she told him, "but you may find that the city is not a healthy place for a growing girl." The bruise those words had won her had been hard to hide from Jamie, but they heard no more about the bastard girl. Catelyn Tully was a mouse, or she would have smothered this Jon Snow in his cradle. Instead, she has left the filthy task to me. "Snow shares Lord Eddard's taste for treason, too," she said. "The father would have handed the realm to Stannis. The son has given him lands and castles."
"The Night's Watch is sworn to take no part in the wars of the Seven Kingdoms," Pycelle reminded them. "For thousands of years the Black Brothers have upheld that tradition."
"Until now," said Cersei. "The bastard boy has written us to avow that the Night's Watch takes no side, but his actions give the lie to his words. He has given Stannis food and shelter.
yet has the insolence to plead with us for arms and men.
An outrage, declared Lord Merryweather. We cannot allow the Night's Watch to join its strength to that of Lord Stannis.
We must declare this Snow a traitor and a rebel, agreed Sir Harris Swift. The Black Brothers must remove him.
Grandmaster Pycelle nodded ponderously.
I propose that we inform Castle Black that no more men will be sent to them until such time as Snow is gone.
Our new Drummonds will need oarsmen, said Orin Waters. Let us instruct the lords to send their poachers and thieves to me henceforth, instead of through the wall.
Kyburn leaned forward with a smile.
The Night's Watch defends us all from snarks and grumpkins. My lords, I say that we must help the brave Black Brothers.
Cersei gave him a sharp look.
What are you saying?
This, Kyburn said. For years now, the Night's Watch has begged for men. Lord Stannis has answered their plea. Can King Tommen do less? His Grace should send the Wall 100 men to take the Black, ostensibly, but in truth,
to remove Snow from the command, Cersei finished, delighted.
I knew I was right to want him on my council.
That is just what we shall do,
she laughed. If this bastard boy is truly his father's son, he will not suspect a thing. Perhaps he will even thank me before the blade slides between his ribs.
It will need to be done carefully, to be sure. Leave the rest to me, my lords.
This was how an enemy should be dealt with a dagger, not a declaration.
We have done good work today, my lords. I thank you. Is there aught else?
One last thing, your grace, said Orion Waters in an apologetic tone. I hesitate to take up the council's time with trifles, but there has been some queer talk heard along the docks of late. Sailors from the east. They speak of dragons.
And manticores, no doubt, and bearded snarks. Cersei chuckled.
Come back to me when you hear talk of dwarfs, my lord.
She stood, to signal that the meeting was at an end. A blustery autumn wind was blowing when Cersei left the council chambers, and bells of blessed Baelor still sang their song of mourning, off across the city. In the yard 20 knights were hammering each other with sword and shield, adding to the din. Sir Boris Blunt escorted the queen back to her apartments, where she found Lady Merryweather chuckling with Jocelyn and Dorcas.
"What is it you all find so amusing?"
"The Redwyn twins," said Tena. "Both of them had fallen in love with Lady Marjorie. They used to fight over which would be the next Lord of the Arbor. Now both of them want to join the King's Guard just to be near the little queen."
"The Redwyns have always had more freckles than wits. It was a useful thing to know, though.
If Horror or Slubber were to be found abed with Marjorie..." Cersei wondered if the little queen liked freckles.
Dorcas, fetch me Sir Osney Kettleblack.
Dorcas blushed.
As you command.
When the girl was gone, Tena Merryweather gave the queen a quizzical look.
Why did she turn so red?
Love.
It was Cersei's turn to laugh. She fancies our Sir Osney. He was the youngest Kettleblack, the clean-shaven one, though he had the same black hair, hooked nose, and easy smile as his brother Osmond. One cheek bore three long scratches, courtesy of one of Tyrion's whores. She likes his scars, I think. Lady Merryweather's dark eyes shone with mischief.
Just so. Scars make a man look dangerous, and danger is exciting.
You shock me, my lady, the queen said, teasing. If danger excites you so, why wed Lord Orton? We all love him, it is true, but still,
Peter had once remarked that the horn of plenty that adorned House Merryweather's arms suited Lord Orton admirably, since he had carrot-coloured hair, a nose as bulbous as a beetroot, and pease porridge for wits.
Tena laughed. "My lord is more bountiful than dangerous. This is so. Yet I hope your grace will not think the less of me. But I did not come a maid entire to Orton's bed.
You're all whores in the free cities, aren't you?
That was good to know. One day she might be able to make use of it. And pray, who was his lover who was so full of danger?"
Tana's olive skin turned even darker as she blushed.
"Oh, I should not have spoken. Your grace will keep my secret, yes?"
"Men have scars, women mysteries." Circe kissed her cheek. "I will have his name out of you soon enough." When Dorcas returned with Sir Usney Kettleblack, the queen dismissed her ladies. "Come, sit with me by the window, Sir Usney.
Will you take a cup of wine?"
She poured for them herself.
"Your coat is threadbare. I have a mind to put you in a new one."
"Why, a white one? Who's died?"
"No one, as yet," the queen said. "Is that your wish, to join your brother Osmond in our king's guard?"
I'd rather be the queen's guard, if it please your grace."
When Osney grinned, the scars on his cheek turned bright red. Cersei's fingers traced their path across his cheek. "You have a bold tongue, sir. You will make me forget myself again."
"Good."
Sir Osney caught her hand and kissed her fingers roughly.
"My sweet queen."
"You are a wicked man," the queen whispered, "and no true knight, I think."
She let him touch her breast through the silk of the gown.
"Enough."
"It isn't. I want you."
"You've had me."
"Only once."
He grabbed her left breast again and gave it a clumsy squeeze that reminded her of Robert.
"One good night for one good night. You did me a valiant service and you had your reward."
Cersei walked her fingers up his laces. She could feel him stiffening through his breeches.
"Was that a new horse you were riding in the yard yestermorn?"
"The black stallion."
"Aye, a gift from my brother, Osfried. Midnight, I call him."
"How wonderfully original."
"A fine mount for a battle. For pleasure, though, there's nothing to compare to a gallop on a spirited young filly."
She gave him a smile and a squeeze.
"Tell me true. Do you think our little queen is pretty?"
Sir Osney drew back, wary.
"I suppose, for a girl, I'd soon have a woman."
"Why not both?" she whispered. "Pluck the little rose for me, and you will not find me to be ungrateful."
"The little Marjorie, you mean?"
Sir Osney's ardour was wilting in his breeches.
"She's a king's wife. Wasn't there some king's guard who lost his head for bedding the king's wife?"
"Ages ago. She was his king's mistress, not his wife, and his head was the only thing he did not lose. Aegon dismembered him, piece by piece, and made the woman watch." Cersei did not want Osney dwelling on that ancient unpleasantness, however.
"Tommen is not Aegon the Unworthy. Have no fear. He will do as I bid him.
I mean for Marjorie to lose her head, not you." That gave him pause.
"Her maidenhead, you mean?"
"That too. Assuming she still has one." She traced his scars again. "Unless you think Marjorie would prove unresponsive to your charms." Osney gave her a wounded look.
"Oh, she likes me well enough. Them cousins of hers always teasing with me about my nose. How big it is and all. The last time Megger did that, Marjorie told them to stop, and said I had a lovely face."
"There you are, then."
"There I am," the man agreed in a doubtful tone. "But where am I going to be if she... if I... after we
do the deed?" Cersei gave him a barb smile. "Lying with a queen is treason. Tommen would have no choice but to send you to the wall."
"The wall?"
he said with dismay. It was all she could do not to laugh. "No, best not. Men hate being laughed at." "A black cloak would go well with your eyes and that black hair of yours."
"No one returns from the wall."
"You will. All you need to do is kill a boy."
"What boy?"
A bastard boy in league with Stannis. He's young and green, and you'll have 100 men. Kettleblack was afraid. She could smell it on him. But he was too proud to own up to that fear. Men are all alike.
I've killed more boys than I can count, he insisted. Once this boy is dead, I get my pardon from the king?
That and a lordship. Unless Snow's brothers hang you first. A queen must have a consort, one who knows no fear.
Lord Kettleblack.
A slow smile spread across his face, and his scars flamed red.
I like the sound of that. A lordly lord,
and fit to bed a queen. He frowned.
The wall is cold,
and I am warm. Cersei put her arms about his neck. Bed a girl and kill a boy, and I am yours. Do you have the courage? Usney thought a moment before he nodded.
I am your man.
You are, sir. She kissed him and let him have a little taste of tongue before she broke away. Enough for now. The rest must wait. Will you dream of me tonight?
Oi!
His voice was hoarse. And when you're abed with our maid Marjorie, she asked him, teasing, when you're in her, will you dream of me then?
I will,
swore Usney Kettleblack. Good. After he was gone, Cersei summoned Jocelyn to brush her hair out while she slipped off her shoes and stretched like a cat. I was made for this, she told herself. It was the sheer elegance of it that pleased her most. Even Mace Tyrell would not dare defend his darling daughter if she was caught in the act with the likes of Usney Kettleblack, and neither Stannis Baratheon nor Jon Snow would have cause to wonder why Usney was being sent to the Wall. She would see to it that Sir Osmond was the one to discover his brother with the little queen. That way the loyalty of the other two Kettleblacks need not be impugned. If father could only see me now, he would not be so quick to speak of marrying me off again. A pity he's so dead. Him and Robert, John Aaron, Ned Stark, Renly Baratheon, all dead. Only Tyrion remains, and not for long. That night the queen summoned Lady Meriwether to her bedchamber. "Will you take a cup of wine?" she asked her. "A small one." The Meerish woman laughed.
A big one.
On the morrow I want you to pay a call on my good daughter, Cersei said, as Dorcas was dressing her for bed.
Lady Marjorie is always happy to see me.
I know. The queen did not fail to note the style that Taina used when referring to Tommen's little wife. Tell her I've sent 7 beeswax candles to the Baelor Sept in memory of our dear High Septon. Taina laughed.
If so, she will send 77 candles of her own, so as not to be outmourned.
I will be very cross if she does not, the queen said, smiling. Tell her also that she has a secret admirer, a knight so smitten with her beauty that he cannot sleep at nights.
Might I ask your grace, which knight?
Mischief sparkled in Taina's big dark eyes.
Could it be Sir Osney?
It could be, the queen said, but do not offer up that name freely. Make her worm it out of you. Will you do that?
If it please you, that is all I wish, your grace.
Outside a cold wind was rising. They stayed up late into the morning, drinking Arbor Gold and telling one another tales. Taina got quite drunk, and Cersei pried the name of her secret lover from her. He was a Meerish sea captain, half a pirate, with black hair to the shoulders and a scar that ran across his face from chin to ear.
100 times I told him no, and he said yes, the other woman told her, until finally I was saying yes as well. He was not the sort of man to be denied.
I know the sort, the queen said with a wry smile.
Has your grace ever known a man like that, I wonder?
Robert, she lied, thinking of Jamie. Yet when she closed her eyes, it was the other brother that she dreamt of, and the three wretched fools with whom she had begun her day. In the dream it was Tyrion's head they brought her in her sack. She had it bronzed, and kept it in her chamber pot. The Iron Captain. The wind was blowing from the north as the Iron Victory came round the point and entered the holy bay called Naga's Cradle. Victorian joined Newt the Barber at her prow. Ahead loomed the sacred shore of Old Wyke, and the grassy hill above it, where the ribs of Naga rose from the earth like the trunks of great white trees, as wide around as a drumman's mast, and twice as tall.
"The bones of the Grey King's Hall."
Victorian could feel the magic of this place.
"Balin stood beneath those bones when he first named himself the king," he recalled. "He swore to win us back our freedoms. And Tarl the thrice drowned placed a driftwood crown upon his head. 'Balon,' they cried. 'Balon, Balon King!'
They will shout your name as loud," said Newt. Victorian nodded, though he did not share the barber's certainty.
"Balon had three sons, and a daughter he loved well."
He had said as much to his captains at Moat Galen when first they urged him to claim the sea stone chair.
"Balon's sons are dead,"
Red Ralph Stonehouse had argued,
"and Asher is a woman. You were your brother's strong right arm. You must pick up the sword that he let fall."
When Victorian reminded them that Balon had commanded him to hold the moat against the Northmen, Ralph Kenning said,
"The wolves are broken, Lord. What good to win this swamp and lose their isles?"
And Ralph the Limper added,
"The crow's eye has been too long away. He knows us not."
Euron Greyjoy, king of the Isles and the North. The thought woke an old rage in his heart, but still...
"Words are wind," Victorian told them, "and the only good wind is that which fills our sails. Would you have me fight the crow's eye? Brother against brother, Ironborn against Ironborn?"
Euron was still his elder, no matter how much bad blood might be between them. Ah, no man is as accursed as the Kingslayer. But when the Damphair's summon came, the call to King's Moot, then all was changed.
"Aaron speaks with the drowned god's voice," Victorian reminded himself. "And if the drowned god wills that I should sit the sea stone chair..."
The next day he gave command of Moat Cailin to Ralph Kenning, and set off overland for the Fever River, where the Iron Fleet lay amongst the reeds and willows. Rough seas and fickle winds had delayed him, but only one ship had been lost, and he was home. Grief and Iron Vengeance were close behind, as Iron Victory passed the headland. Behind came Hard Hand, Iron Wind, Grey Ghost, Lord Quellan, Lord Vicon, Lord Dagon, and the rest 9/10 of the Iron Fleet, sailing on the evening tide in a ragged column that extended back long leagues. The sight of their sails filled Victorian Greyjoy with content. No man had ever loved his wives half as well as the Lord Captain loved his ships. Along the sacred strand of Old Wyke, longships lined the shore as far as the eye could see, their masts thrust up like spears. In the deeper waters rode prizes, cogs, carracks, and drummonds, one in raid or war too big to run ashore. From prow and stern and mast flew familiar banners. Newt the Barber squinted toward the strand.
"Is that Lord Arlor's sea song?"
The barber was a thick-set man with bandy legs and long arms, but his eyes were not so keen as they had been when he was young. In those days he could throw an axe so well that men said he could shave you with it.
"A sea song, aye."
Roderick the Reader had left his books, it would seem.
"And there's old Drum's Thunderer, with Black Tide's Night Flyer beside her."
Victorian's eyes were as sharp as they had ever been. Even with their sails furled and their banners hanging limp, he knew them, as befit the Lord Captain of the Iron Fleet.
"Silverfin, too," some kin of Sir Wayne Botley.
The crow's eye had drowned Lord Botley, Victorian had heard, and his heir had died at Moat Cailin. But there had been brothers and other sons as well.
How many?
Four?
No, five. And none with any cause to love the crow's eye.
And then he saw her, a single-masted galley, lean and low, with a dark red hull. Her sails, now furled, were black as a starless sky. Even at anchor, silence looked both cruel and fast. On her prow was a black iron maiden with one arm outstretched. Her waist was slender, her breasts high and proud, her legs long and shapely. A wind-blown mane of black iron hair streamed from her head, and her eyes were mother-of-pearl. But she had no mouth. Victorian's hands closed into fists. He had beaten four men to death with those hands, and one wife as well. Though his hair was flecked with hoarfrost, he was as strong as he had ever been, with a bull's broad chest and a boy's flat belly.
"The Kingslayer is accursed in the eyes of gods and men,"
Balin had reminded him on the day he sent the crow's eye off to sea.
"He is here," Victorian told the barber. "Drop sail. We proceed on oars alone. Command grief and earn vengeance to stand between silence and the sea. The rest of the fleet to seal the bay. None is to leave save at my command, neither man nor crew."
The men upon the shore had spied their sails. Shouts echoed across the bay as friends and kin called out greetings, but not from silence. On her decks a motley crew of mutes and mongrels spoke no word as the Iron Victory drew nigher. Men, black as tar, stared out at him, and others squat and hairy as the apes of Sotheris.
"Monsters," Victorian thought.
They dropped anchor 20 yards from silence.
"Lower a boat. I would go ashore."
He buckled on his sword belt as the rowers took their places. His long sword rested on one hip, a dirk upon the other. Newt the barber fastened the Lord Captain's cloak about his shoulders. It was made of 9 layers of cloth of gold, sewn in the shape of the Kraken of Greyjoy, arms dangling to his boots. Beneath he wore heavy grey chainmail over boiled black leather. In Moat Cailin he had taken to wearing mail day and night. Sore shoulders and an aching back were easier to bear than bloody bowels. The poisoned arrows of the bug devils need only scratch a man, and a few hours later he would be squirting and screaming as his life ran down his legs in gouts of red and brown.
"Whoever wins the sea stone chair, I shall deal with the bug devils."
Victorian donned a tall black war helm, wrought in the shape of an iron kraken. Its arms coiled down around his cheeks to meet beneath his jaw. By then the boat was ready.
"I put the chests into your charge," he told Newt as he climbed over the side. "See that they are strongly guarded."
Much depended on the chests.
"As you command, Your Grace."
Victorian returned a sour scowl.
"I am no king as yet."
He clambered down into the boat. Aaron Damfair was waiting for him in the surf, with his waterskin slung beneath one arm. The priest was gaunt and tall, though shorter than Victorian. His nose rose like a shark's fin from a bony face, and his eyes were iron. His beard reached to his waist, and tangled ropes of hair slapped at the back of his legs when the wind blew.
"Brother," he said, as the waves broke white and cold around their ankles, "what is dead can never die."
"But rises again, harder and stronger."
Victorian lifted off his helm and knelt. The bay filled his boots and soaked his breeches as Aaron poured a stream of salt water down upon his brow. And so they prayed.
"Where is our brother, Crow's Eye?"
the Lord Captain demanded of Aaron Damfair when the prayers were done.
"He is in the great tent of cloth of gold, there where the din is loudest. He surrounds himself with godless men and monsters,
worse than before. In him our father's blood went bad.
Our mother's blood as well. Victorian would not speak of kingslaying. Here in this godly place, beneath the bones of Naga and the great king's hall. But many a night he dreamed of driving a mail fist into Euron's smiling face, until the flesh split and his bad blood ran red and free.
I must not. I pledge my word to Balon.
All have come? He asked his priestly brother.
All who matter. The captains and the kings.
On the Iron Islands they were one and the same, for every captain was a king on his own deck, and every king must be a captain.
Do you mean to claim our father's crown?
Victorian imagined himself seated on the sea stone chair.
If the drowned god wills it.
The waves will speak, said Aaron Damfair, as he turned away. Listen to the waves, brother.
Aye. He wondered how his name would sound, whispered by waves, and shouted by captains and the kings.
If the cup should pass to me, I will not set it by.
A crowd had gathered round to wish him well and seek his favour. Victorian saw men from every isle, black-tides, tawnies, orkwoods, stone-trees, winches, and many more. The good brothers of Old Wyke, the good brothers of Great Wyke, and the good brothers of Orkman all had come. The Cods were there, though every decent man despised them. Humble shepherds, weavers, and netleys rubbed shoulders with men from houses ancient and proud. Even humble humbles, the blood of thralls and salt wives. A Volmark clapped Victorian on the back. Two spars pressed a wineskin into his hands. He drank deep, wiped his mouth, and let them bear him off to their cook-fires, to listen to their talk of war and crowns and plunder, and the glory and the freedom of his reign. That night the men of the Iron Fleet raised a huge sailcloth tent above the tideline. Sir Victorian might feast 50 famous captains on roast kid, salted cod, and lobster. Aaron came as well. He ate fish and drank water, whilst the captains quaffed enough ale to float the Iron Fleet. Many promised him their voices. Freyleg the Strong, clever Arvin Sharp, humpbacked Hotho Harlaw. Hotho offered him a daughter for his queen.
I have no luck with waves,
Victorian told him. His first wife died in childbed, giving him a stillborn daughter. His second had been stricken by a pox, and his third...
A king must have an heir,
Hotho insisted.
The Crow's Eye brings 3 sons to show before the king's moot.
Ah, bastards and mongrels. How old is this daughter?
12, said Hotho. Fair and fertile, newly flowered, but hair the colour of honey. Her breasts are small as yet, but she has good hips. She takes after her mother more than me.
Victorian knew that to mean the girl did not have a hump. Yet when he tried to picture her, he only saw the wife he'd killed. He had sobbed each time he struck her, and afterwards carried her down to the rocks to give her to the crabs.
I will gladly look on the girl once I am crowned, he said.
That was as much as Hotho dared hope for, and he shambled off, content. Balor Blacktide was more difficult to please. He sat by Victorian's elbow in his lamb's wool tunic of black and green vary, smooth-faced and comely. His cloak was sable and pinned with a silver 7-pointed star. He had been 8 years a hostage in Oldtown and had returned a worshipper of the 7 Greenland gods.
Balon was mad, Aaron is madder, and Euron is maddest of them all,
Lord Balor said.
And what of you, Lord Captain? If I shout your name, will you make an end of this mad war?
Victorian frowned.
Would you have me bend the knee?
If need be.
We cannot stand alone against all Westeros.
King Robert proved that, to our grief. Balon would pay the iron price for freedom, he said. But our women bought Balon's crowns with empty beds. My mother was one such.
The old way is dead.
Ah, what is dead can never die, but rises harder and stronger. In 100 years men will sing of Balon the Bold.
Balon the Widowmaker, call him. I will gladly trade his freedom for a father. Have you one to give me? When Victorian did not answer, Blacktide snorted and moved off. The tent grew hot and smoky. Two of Goril Goodbrother's sons knocked a table over fighting. Will Humble lost a wager and had to eat his boot. Little Linwood Tawney fiddled, whilst Romney Weaver sang The Bloody Cop and Steel Rain, and other old reeving songs. Carl the Maid and Eldred Cod danced the finger dance. A roar of laughter went up when one of Eldred's fingers landed in Rafe the Limper's wine cup. A woman was among those laughing. Victorian rose and saw her by the tent flap, whispering something in the ear of Carl the Maid that made him laugh as well. He had hoped she would not be fool enough to come here, yet the sight of her made him smile all the same. "Asher!" he called in a commanding voice. "Niece!" She made her way to his side, lean and lithe, in high boots of salt-stained leather, green woollen breeches, and brown quilted tunic, a sleeveless leather jerkin half unlaced. "Nuncle!" Asher Greyjoy was tall for a woman, yet she had to stand on her toes to kiss his cheek. "I am pleased to see you at my queen's moot." "A queen's moot?" Victorian laughed. "How you drunk, niece? Sit. I did not spy your black wind on the strand. I beached her beneath Norn Goodbrother's castle and rode across the island." She sat on a stool and helped herself unasked to Newt the barber's wine. Newt raised no objection. He had passed out drunk some time ago.
"Who holds the moat? Rafe Kenning. With the young wolf dead, only the bug devils remain to plague us. The Starks were not the only Norsemen. The Iron Throne has named the Lord of the Dreadfort as Warden of the North. Would you lessen me in warfare? I was fighting battles when you were sucking mother's milk. And losing battles, too."
Asher took a drink of wine. Victorian did not like to be reminded of Fair Isle.
"Every man should lose a battle in his youth, so he does not lose a war when he is old. You have not come to make a claim, I hope."
She teased him with a smile.
"And if I have? If there a man who, remember, when you were a little girl, swimming naked in the sea and playing with your doll. I played with axes, too."
"You did,"
he had to grant.
"But a woman wants a husband, not a crown. When I am king, I'll give you one. Oh, my uncle is so good to me. Shall I find a pretty wife for you when I am queen? I have no luck with waves. How long have you been here?" "Long enough to see that Uncle Dampfair has woken more than he intended. The drum means to make a claim, and Tarl the Thrice-Drowned was heard to say that Merin Volmark is the true heir of the Black Lion. The king must be a kraken. The Crow's Eye is a kraken. The elder brother comes before the younger."
Asher leaned closer.
"But I am the child of King Balin's brother, so I come before you both. Hear me, Nuncle."
But then a sudden silence fell. The singing died. Little Linwood Tawney lowered his fiddle. Men turned their heads. Even the clatter of plates and knives was hushed. A dozen newcomers had entered the feast tent. Victorian saw pinch-faced John Meyer, tall old Brown Tooth, left-hand Lucas Codd. German Botley crossed his arms against the gilded breastplate he had taken off a Lannister captain during Balon's first rebellion. Orkwood of Orkmont stood beside him. Behind them were Stonehand, Kellan Humble, and the red oarsman with his fiery hair in braids. Rafe the Shepherd, too, and Rafe of Lordsport, and Carl the Thrall. And the Crow's Eye, Euron Greyjoy.
"Ah, he looks unchanged," Victorian thought. "He looks the same as he did the day he laughed at me and left."
Euron was the most comely of Lord Kellan's sons, and 3 years of exile had not changed that. His hair was still black as a midnight sea, with never a whitecap to be seen, and his face was still smooth and pale beneath his neat dark beard. A black leather patch covered Euron's left eye, but his right was blue as a summer sky.